Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Positive Pessimist Podcast. It's Wrestling Wednesday. My guest today is Trent Paulson. Trent Paulson was an NCAA champion for Iowa State in 2007. He was a three-time All-American. He was 192-2 in high school for the state of Iowa. He made the world team. He's now an assistant coach at the University of Virginia, along with his brother Travis, who is also a phenomenal wrestler. They both made world teams, so I'm very excited to have him on today. And if you're in the Iowa area, Des Moines, Iowa specifically, I will be headlining the Funny Bone there April 26 and 27. Make sure you get tickets to see me and my buddy Kurt Fletcher. He's the guy that does the Stop Stalling podcast with me during the college season. So it's a great room. I'm really looking forward to it. And without any further ado, let's bring in the man, Trent Paulson. So I was curious, are you related to Brandon Paulson?
No, everyone asked me that. I thought he spelled his name S-E-N. I thought, at least that's how I thought the spelling was back in the day, but I just saw him on Facebook and it is O-N. But no, there's no relation there. My dad's parents sailed over on a boat from Yugoslavia. They didn't speak English. And most of our family on my dad's side are all Serbian. That's where the Paulson name comes from.
Okay. All right, I was just curious because I had Dennis Hall on not too long ago, and it's been a while actually, but he had that epic match with Brandon Paulson, and I just didn't know, but that's cool. Are you looking forward to the Olympic trials this weekend?
Yeah, I'm excited to see what JALO can do. That dude's been training his nuts off. He couldn't be training any harder.
You're excited to see what who can do?
JALO at 97 kilo. He's the sixth seed.
Okay. Cool, man. Is that the weight class you're looking forward to the most?
Yeah, just because it's the only weight class we have a guy in it.
Yeah.
But there are some – I'm excited to see who is the last man standing at 74 and 86 probably the most.
74 and 86. Yeah. Do you have a pick or do you just like to see it play out?
I mean, Taylor got past Brooks by the skin of his teeth last time on some pretty close calls. And I think when you say David Taylor's name, he's been the best in the world for so long. But there's also another dude that's been right behind him that's hungry, that's younger, that I'm really excited to see who comes out on that. I had a buddy that trained there, and he said that like at this point, they don't really roll that much. Like it's getting close where they sense it.
Yeah, I bet. And whoever wins that, I mean, obviously there's that Iranian guy, but whoever wins that is probably the favorite to win the Olympics, I would think. I mean, Aaron Brooks is freaking great.
Yeah, he's, and I think going up a weight class, not having to cut any weight, just focus on getting better. He looked the best he ever has even up.
Yeah,
adding that size and strength, and I think he's going to be hard to beat. One thing that helps Taylor though is sitting out that whole time while Brooks has to go through some tough matches before.
Yeah,
you can get through all those matches healthy, and it'll be interesting.
Yeah, for sure. You and your brother are both in the Iowa Hall of Fame. You're both multiple-time state champs. You were both three-time All-Americans and made world teams and all that. Is it safe to say that you guys beat the crap out of each other growing up?
Yeah, we had to be separated a lot because we'd rather probably break your arm before you give up a takedown. It was like that much bragging rights once you got home, either at the home or the dorm or after college when we lived in a rental property together. But yeah, it'd roll over to the house too. There'd be holes in drywall, broken door hinges. The competitiveness amongst brothers, especially when they're identical, the same size and weight. Everything's even. You can't say that he's the older brother or he's bigger because he won. Everything's equal. Neither one wants to lose.
Yeah. My brother was about almost 2 years older than me, and I could not stand him scoring on me or beating me. And he could usually beat me, especially after we got older. Like when I was like 12 and 14, he could really kind of kick my butt, and nothing made me just crazy mad more than that. When you guys got older, I mean, this is something I was going to ask later in the podcast, but when you had to wrestle in that world team trials, How was that like leading up to it, and like afterwards? Was there like a cool down period, or were you guys joking around beforehand? Or
We weren't joking around beforehand. We were taking it pretty seriously, but still training in that room. Like the week before the competition, we were still drilling together, doing simulation matches. It's not like we were avoiding one another. We knew it was likely, but we knew we could still make each other the best. And the reason we ended up actually scrapping that match is because we had met several times throughout our career, but our parents made us flip a coin and say, rather than hurting each other or broken home feelings, we'll take turns. Whoever does the bet, whoever got the previous one has to forfeit the next time. But when the world team spot's on the line, you just can't really do that. You can't justify it. And he was a better man that day. It sucks to say, but, there was no animosity on my end after the match. It was just like, if you can't turn things around and hope the best for your brother, if you have to get taken out by anybody, that's, I feel like, the best pill to swallow when it's your blood and you can still see him accomplish his goals.
Right. So when you were kids, did one or the other ever lose the coin toss like 3 times in a row? And you're like, this is...
They did the coin toss the first time. And then after that result, we took turns every time.
Okay.
No, if it was constant coin tosses, we probably, that wouldn't be good.
That'd be a fight on its own. You'd be like, you've won 4 coin tosses.
Yeah, you're rigging it, Mom.
So you both had great high school careers. You were also won the Dave Schultz Award, which do more than one people get person gets that, or is that just one guy that gets that? Is that like the Heisman of high school?
It's one guy gets it per state.
Okay.
So okay. I can hold that over Travis's head because I got over him, but Travis always says he had another state title than me. He won 3, I won 2, but I lost at the wrong times. I was 192-2, and my 2 losses were my freshman year in the semis and my sophomore year in the finals.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering about that. So after you had this awesome high school career, you both went to Iowa State. You obviously probably had a lot of offers. Did you consider going anywhere else, or was it always going to be Iowa State?
Mm-hmm. Nebraska was up there. You and I was up there. Travis actually, when it came time to make the decision, he wanted to go to Oklahoma and I wanted to go to Iowa State. And pretty much what happened was Iowa State's 2 hours away. Oklahoma's 8 hours away. Travis, you're going where Trent's going because you're not separating.
Yeah.
But Travis, I think he wanted to go to Oklahoma more because David Kilgard, who was a bad mammer jammer from our high school that was valedictorian and he was the number one pound for pound recruit his senior year. He hosted us on our trip to Oklahoma. And I think he just wanted to follow in that dude's footsteps.
Yeah.
And Jack Spates was hilarious. He's almost like a stand-up comedian like you. There's an art to it. And when we were at dinner, we were laughing the whole time. And I think when you're around hungry dudes that want to win and you're laughing the whole time, it's hard to turn down.
Yeah. So what ultimately led you to go to Iowa State then?
I think Kale, he was in the hunt for his 4th. Bono was an assistant coach. He was around our weight making world teams. Bobby Douglas was the Olympic coach. And we had world Olympic aspirations. So it just made sense.
Yeah. Has there ever been a stockier 150-pounder than Chris Bono?
No. It's hard to beat his head hands to say the least. But
yeah. How tall is that dude? 5'2", 5'3"?
Yeah, he's around there. And okay. The funny thing is, now I know he's a little older now, but now I think he walks around like 143.
Really?
Yeah, he's almost shrunk a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember those matches he had with McIlravey and just watching him and being like, man, this guy, I don't know how anybody scores on him.
He's a block. One of the heaviest collar ties you'll feel.
Yeah, I think so. He was the assistant when you got there?
Yep.
Because he graduated, what, like 2001 or something?
Yeah, I think I think he had been the assistant coach for a couple years because he was the assistant when Kale won his 4th.
Okay. So tell me about your career there. Did you guys compete right away? Were you able to compete right away? Was there a learning curve?
I felt like we could wrestle with the best guys in the room right when we got there. But Coach Douglas was pretty passionate about us redshirting. I think he knew the class we had, and if we all stuck together, that we could have a pretty good team down the road.
Yeah.
So, we redshirted, but I think my redshirt year, when I went to all the Opens, I went 17-1, and my only loss was to TJ Williams.
And that's Joe Williams' little brother, right?
Yeah, and he was graduated at the time. He was training for the Olympics, but I think he just jumped in the UNI Open to get matches, to get ready, and okay. He beat me in the finals.
Yeah, you always hear these stories. I'm friends with Eric Aiken, and he was telling me that he couldn't get a takedown for like a month. So you weren't that guy.
No. Massey had us pretty good prepared, and I think we were pretty physically strong going from high school to college, so it wasn't as big of a factor there dealing with the more mature guys.
Yeah. Do you think that's one of the biggest differences between great high school wrestlers and great college wrestlers is strength?
I'd say it's not as much strength. I felt like that was kind of a helpful equalizer for me, but I think it's more the mind. Do you think you're the guy or not? Are you going to take a back seat because you're wrestling guys that are 4 or 5 years older than you? Do you think you can win now? Because it doesn't matter how much the coaches believe in you. It's, do you believe in you? Do you think you can get it done? And yeah. I think we're seeing that at the high school level now with guys believing in, like, the RTCs, them being able to get into college rooms early, them at the Olympic Training Center training with the national team. You're seeing 17-year-old kids knock off guys that have trained for an Olympic cycle.
It's crazy, right? I mean, you know, there was a time 10, 15, 20 years ago, especially, that if you said a high school guy was going to tech fall a former NCAA champion, you think they were crazy, but now yeah. We're seeing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Back in the day, I think Mark Schwab might've done it. I think Joe Russell was up there. I think Colot was maybe in that league, but it was very, very few and far between. And now you're seeing 2 to 3 guys in each high school class, which is unheard of.
Yeah. So tell me about your college career then. Just go through the years there.
So I already said freshman year redshirt year, I went 17-1. Sophomore year, I went 49. I probably should have been a 57, but we were a better team. And I started out the first half 20-0. I was ranked second in the country. I won Midlands and got OW. But each week, I was yo-yoing about 15, 18 pounds. In the second half of the season, I felt like it caught up to me. I wasn't ready for the grind of a D1 season with that much of a weight cut. And I think the back half, I was 500. I think I finished the season 28-8. I was still the 5 seed at Nationals, and I lost in the blood round. And my twin brother, Travis, I think he got 6th that year, but he had a good season. He was an All-American as a freshman.
And he was he at 57?
Yeah, he was at 57.
Okay.
So then the next year, I said, screw this, I'm going 57. And Travis was like, all right, I'll try to get bigger. I think like by midseason, he was pretty, like, he wasn't undersized, but he grew into the weight class midway through the season. But he had a rib injury, and that he actually lost in the blood round his sophomore year to a guy that he had beaten several times. But my sophomore year, I moved up to 57. I was ranked in the top 5 all year, but I remember at Midlands, I wrestled the returning champ, Gentry, in the semis. I lost by a point or two, and I knew I believed that I could beat him if that's what it came down to for the national title. And I actually had him in the quarterfinals that year, and I beat him. And then in the semis, I lost to Ryan Bertine from Michigan, who ended up winning his second title. He beat me, I think, 10-7. But he controlled the match. He got all the takedowns, and he was more skilled than me at the time. And I came back and got 4th. Who did I have for 4th that year? Percival from Ohio.
Okay. Yeah, I remember this year was like the biggest semi-slide year ever, maybe. I mean, I think 7 guys that made the finals ended up, or semifinals ended up 6th. That's a real mental battle to lose in the semis and then even get in for 3rd, is it not?
Yeah, it's, I mean, if you lose in the semis and you get 3rd, I think that's harder to do than win, because you just had your dreams crushed and you have to go get the next best thing, and that's very hard to do.
Yeah.
when the next best thing isn't what you wanted.
Yeah.
And yeah, when you said the backside slide, that made me think of Andoni, and he lost in overtime right there to be in the finals, could have won, and then he gets pinned three times in a row. And he's a very high-level wrestler. He's exciting. Sometimes it's live by the sword, die by the sword. But I was surprised to see that.
Yeah, and he's a senior, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have another – I talked to my buddy. We have a podcast called Stop Stalling. We were talking about that. Like, he had this great career, and I don't know him personally, but I hope he's able to bounce back from that, because that would be hard to deal with, you know?
Yeah. And yeah. He has high-level freestyle skills, so I hope to see him on the circuit. I know. I think he made a junior world team.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very exciting.
And on I was going to say, on the flip side of that, one of the most impressive bounce backs I saw was Crookham.
Yeah.
The way they seeded him based on his season was crazy. And then to lose to a guy that you beat twice, who's a world champ in his own right, and then bounce back and beat the guy that you already had to beat on the front side. To beat a really, really good guy twice in the same tournament is hard to do, especially coming off a heartbreaking loss and your only loss of the season. That just made me get more and more respect for that kid.
Yeah. Yeah. He's really good, man. I enjoyed watching him this year too. And he looked, what's that like to coach the NCAA tournament?
I always say it's a roller coaster, the highs of highs and the lows of lows. Like when Mueller made the semis, I remember he was like freaking out, and instead of embracing me in a hug, he kind of like gave me a slap in the face. I was like, dude, how I spent all these countless hours. We do all this work, and then you pretty much backhand slap me in the face when you make the finals, and then excitement, you'll do crazy stuff. But he, that's like a high example. And then you'll have somebody that has done everything they can. That's the next year we had three guys losing the blood round. And for that to go back to back to back, and you're confident in each guy winning, it's hard to put into words the feelings you have after a round like that.
Yeah. Is Jack Mueller still wrestling? I always liked Jack Mueller.
So Jack Mueller was wrestling, and then he was coaching with us for 2 years, and then he decided to go into seminary school. So we moved back to Dallas, and he's taking that route.
Okay. Good for him. So tell me about the rest of your career. Then your junior year.
My junior year, I always say that I choked. I had a good season. I was the number one seed at Nationals. And then in the quarterfinals, I lost to Joe Johnson, who I had, I think, beat by 7 or 8 in the duel earlier that season. And I think I beat him in the Kauffman Brand Open, too. So I let the pressure of being the one seed, the guy that's supposed to win, make me try to protect or try to wrestle not to lose as opposed to win. And then fast forward to my senior year. That summer, my junior year, at the World Team Trials, I knocked off Joe Williams first round, and I made the finals of the mini tournament. That gave me a lot of confidence going into my senior year, knowing that I'd beaten multiple-time national champs in that summer, and knowing I'd already been the one seed once. If I just put it all together, I can get it done.
Yeah. Did you get to wrestle Joe Johnson again in that tournament?
No, he was a year older than me. So, oh, no, Joe Johnson, that tournament, he came back, I think, and got 6th or 7th, and I got 4th.
Okay.
I lost to Minotti for 3rd and 4th, who Coach Garland's in the other room. He used to coach at Cornell when I competed against Minotti.
And Garland's at your house right now?
So I'm in my office, and his office is right over there. But
okay.
I wrestled Minotti in the Midlands Finals, and I beat him when I was a freshman. That's when I got the OW, and then he beat me 2 years later for 3rd. And he's like, we got the last win. It came down to coaching. I was like, we like to give each other a hard time, but that's how that match ended. And then my senior year, I was the one seed again, and I got it done. I think took it one match at a time and wasn't thinking about the win, just thinking about scoring the next point. And I think it kind of took care of itself.
Yeah. It's crazy how that works out sometimes. So how did that feel finally getting that monkey off your back?
Relief, overjoyed, hearted gratitude for all the people that got me there. I feel like Iowa is unmatched in how they treat their wrestling champions. I'm sure David Carr could probably share that with what he just did with O'Toole, but Iowa's a special place, and it almost felt like there was a parade for me when I got back to Iowa State. They recognized me at halftime of a football game. my professor, the professors in my classes gave me a standing ovation. It was just, it was really special, and there's a lot of respect.
Yeah, that's freaking awesome, dude. I can't imagine what that would feel like. I mean, I won a state title. That felt pretty good. But to win an NCAA has got to be just a freaking crazy feeling. So who did you beat in the finals that year?
Craig Henning.
Okay.
He was a three-time All-American. He's the one they changed the conference rule for, because he was a three-time All-American, and he was 1 year younger than me. So his senior year at Big Tens, I think he got upset. And then the next match, I think he was injured, or I can't remember exactly what happened, but he didn't place at his conference tournament, and they had no body of work or RPI criteria. So if you didn't have a placement at your conference, you couldn't get a wild card for the NCAA. So his senior year, he didn't get to go.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
Yeah.
After being the runner-up, he didn't get a
three-time All-American, probably beat everybody that placed that year, but he had a rough Big Tens and didn't get to go.
Wow. Man, that would wear on you for years, I would imagine. So who else were you teammates with? I mean, besides your brother, and Kale was there your freshman year, right?
Kale was there the whole time training, and then my senior year, he took over as head coach.
Okay.
But teammate-wise, Nate Gallick, Nick Gallick, Zach Roberson, Grant Nakamura, who else? Nick Pasolano, Kurt Backus, Jake Varner, Nick Fanthorpe. There's a lot of I'm just trying to name off all the All-Americans on the top of my head. My senior year, we had three in the finals, me, Varner, and Backus. Backus lost in overtime. I think Varner lost a close match to Herbert. But we had a ton of studs. I know David Zabriskie.
I didn't realize you were there with Zach Roberson.
Yeah, he was a senior when I was a freshman.
Okay, so the year he won it, you were a freshman.
Yeah, and he missed weight at the World Team Trials, and actually it was the Olympic Trials in 2008. I think Zadik, the weight class wasn't qualified, so a lot of people moved up or down, because even if he won the Olympic Trials, there was a good chance he didn't get to wrestle at the Olympics. So Roberson was at my weight for the Olympic Trials in 2008, and I think I had him in the consolation quarters, and I beat him, but I think size had a lot to do with it, because that was a very, very highly skilled dude.
Oh, yeah. He was great. He was one of the few guys from – I was from Kansas. I grew up in Kansas, and I had graduated for a few years by the time he came around. But his older brother, Josh, was on my college team for a year, I believe, and he was telling us about his little brother. And – you know, you hear stuff like that and you're like, yeah, whatever, your little brother's good. And then he ended up being two or three time All-American and national champ. And what was he like? I've never talked to Zach.
He's an awesome dude. He's pretty much the guy on the team that it's impossible to dislike. Almost always in a good mood, kind of happy go lucky, pretty funny in his own right. The thing that stands out about Zach, if you looked at him with his shirt off, he doesn't look like much, but when you wrestled him, he had like a weird wrestling strength, and he was highly, highly technical. Like, you'd call a time and you'd do that side pitch and he'd be behind you before you even knew it.
Huh.
Could shoot both sides of the body, could get out on bottom, could ride. Other than that, he sucked.
So what was it like to be on the same team as Kale when he's going for his fourth?
So Kale was a senior in college when I was a senior in high school. So when I came on my recruiting trip is when he was going for his fourth. And I didn't get to be like on the team when he was training like that. But I remember him when he became the coach, he'd talk about one thing that was kind of a struggle when he was going for his fourth was expectations of others and making stuff more than it's not. Like the pressure, he's every match, I'm 151 or no, I'm 157 or no, I'm one. Like, is he going to stay perfect? And when you try to make it something that it's not, then you, like what I said my junior year, you wrestle out of character and stuff that shouldn't happen happens. So he did a really good job of breaking it down. He'd say stuff like, there's no such thing as a stalemate. Like, if you get in a position where you feel like you're neutralized, keep trying to win the position, keep trying to advance, keep trying to score points. Because if you're worried about a stalemate, you're not focusing on scoring, you're focusing on winning. And little triggers like that. Before practices, he would tell us, like, analogies to get our mind to think about similar things. Like, he'd say battleships are made and they're safe at the harbor, but they're meant to go to war. So if you're just standing around and not going to war, not really trying to score points, then you're not really doing what you were made to do.
Did he come up with that stuff, or is that stuff like he came got heard from his dad, or do you know?
I don't know. He never really revealed his secrets. I'm guessing he was like Googling motivational quotes and just but it definitely worked, and it kind of reminded me, like, biblically how Jesus, when he would teach, he would give parables. And when you would think about the parables, it would make the connection with what it was really trying to get you to think about.
Yeah. So is he as laid back a person as he seems to be?
Extremely laid back, extremely like a dry sense of humor. And it's hard to tell when he's joking or when he's serious. Because okay. Sometimes he would be joking and you think he would be serious, and then vice versa. He'd actually be serious and, like, you're like, yeah, okay, whatever. He's like, I'm serious. And, like, you could tell because he would punch his jaw. I'll be like, all right, yeah, this dude's serious this time. Hard to read.
Yeah. Did he ever get mad?
Yeah, but it was pretty rare. And it was mainly if someone didn't wrestle the way they were capable.
Okay. I can't even really picture it, him getting mad about something.
Yeah, it's never, like, publicly mad. It's behind closed doors.
I think it was Tony Perler that told me that, I'm probably going to butcher the story, but, like, before Kale's freshman year, when he was wrestling Egham for his first title, like, Egham came out or something, and Kale, instead of, like, warming up, was, like, pitching cards into a hat or something, you know? And supposedly Egham was, like, he knew he was in trouble. Like, this kid doesn't even... He's not nervous at all. He's 18 years old. He's getting ready to wrestle for, or 19, whatever he was, getting ready to wrestle for his first title. And he's just, like, playing some game. He wasn't even. So it seemed like he was a master of not letting it get to him, like any kind of pressure.
Yeah, I think the cheat code with Kale was his view. I think he preaches it all the time now at Penn State. But wrestling, it's a sport. It's something you do. It's something to have fun with. It doesn't define you. And him being able to separate the two, I think allowed him to wrestle free.
Yeah. What was Jake Varner like as a teammate?
Jake Varner was, he was pretty serious too. Didn't joke around a ton. Pretty conservative. He led by example with how hard he worked. When I think of Jake Varner, I think of an extremely strong dude. You know who Jake Varner reminds me of is Levi Haynes, the way he wrestles.
Okay.
Pretty much impossible to score on. When he gets to the leg, he finishes and mean on top.
Yeah. Yeah, he was mean, man.
If he got that half, it was probably the match was over.
Yeah. So your coach there for your 5 years then was it all 5 years that Bobby Douglas was your coach?
Well, Bobby was 4 years, and then my senior year, Kale took over. So when I won nationals my senior year, I was actually Kale's first national champ. And they gave him the chair that he sat on. And I was training at Penn State in like 2012-ish, 2013. And he gave me the chair, which was pretty cool. Full circle moment.
Yeah. Where's that chair at in your house?
Yeah. I have a 7 and 9 year old, and there's probably markers on it and food stains. And they're like jumping and dropping the people's elbow off of it. Like they.
Yeah. Are your boys wrestling?
Yeah, they are. My 9-year-old Nick got 5th at state this year, and my 7-year-old Trey got lost in the blood round.
Okay.
This was their 3rd year, and they're starting to get pretty into it.
Cool. Yeah, I've got some questions towards the end about that. I've got a 5-year-old who I want to get into it, but I don't want him to get into it too early. I feel like right now, if he got in there with some kid who knew what he was doing and he couldn't get out on bottom or something, he would just lose his mind and be like, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
So I feel like I have to, like, ease him into it. I'm not sure exactly how to go about it.
Yeah, I plan to start him, like, around that. My plan was 6-ish, 7-ish. But when Nick started at 6 and Trey was on the wall at 4, there was no keeping him off the wall. He's he's got high energy, and he jumped in there at four and never really looked back. But at that age, their attention span's about 30 seconds. So you just have to do the basics of the basics and let them have fun. Mix in a lot of games and stuff like that.
Yeah, my little boy is so – he's already got this crazy competitiveness to the point where it's annoying. Like, if I try to show him something, he's like, I already know that. And I'm like, no, you don't. You don't know anything.
That's a constant battle. And it's hard balancing that with being a dad and a coach.
Yeah, I bet.
Because so, it's hard to leave those practices in the room.
Yeah. I got him to do a penetration step yesterday, and he was kind of doing it right. And then I was like, all right, now try to do it a couple times in a row. And I did it. And then he got mad. He's like, I already know how to. I'm like, you don't know.
I've done it once. I've mastered it. Leave me alone.
Yeah, he's pretty funny. But he drives me crazy, too. I'm just like, dude, I'm not even trying to, like, this is why you do it. I'm just like, hey, man, you know.
One thing that's crazy, too, when you're coaching your kid is in competitions. Like you always bleed for the guy that you're coaching for, but it's like an extra high intensity pulling for him to win when it's your own kid.
Yeah.
And like, if there's a coach that's like saying stuff, like not even necessarily anything crazy, like he's getting tired or like, I don't know, like wrestling stuff. Like if like they call potentially dangerous and they're about to rip off his shoulder. And then the other coach complains because they didn't let him rip off his shoulder. You're like, are you a little bit like, I'll rip off your shoulder. Like stupid stuff like that you wouldn't normally say, but the stakes are high when it's your kid.
Yeah. I can't imagine, man. It's going to be interesting. So what's Bobby like as a coach and a person?
Bobby was a wealth of knowledge. He was like a second father. What stands out to Bobby for me was how much he cared about his athletes outside the room. He'd take us to dinner probably bi-weekly. He was constantly calling and wouldn't call anything about wrestling, would ask about school, life, how's your family doing? Even if it's like a 2-minute conversation in and out, he was checking up on you, making sure everything was good. And him winning the first national title outside a power like the Midwest when he did it at Arizona State really stood out, that he was able to accomplish that. And then all of his world beating Gable, getting third at the Olympics, just all of his stats, been there, done that, did things that people said couldn't be done. He was just, when he talked, people listened.
Is he still involved in the sport? You never hear much, you know, like about Bobby doing anything.
I don't think he has a ton of involvement in the sport at this point. I think his wife has some health issues, so he helps take care of her. And he has a son, too, that he has to take care of. So I think he's pretty busy with that.
Yeah. I read somewhere, I did a lot of research on you before I did this, that you do a good Bobby Douglas impersonation. Do you do other impersonations or just Bobby?
Just mainly Bobby, just because I've heard that voice so many times. And I knew how to get reactions out of him, and he had like these, I don't want to call them tics, but things that he was like very passionate about, and he would forget about them. But if you reminded him on point, he'd get like an example was headgears. It's an NCAA rule to wear a headgear, but if you go into any college room at any practice, probably at least half the guys don't have headgears on. And we'd be warming up and guys' headgears would be in the locker room at the rec center at Iowa State. You had to go down a staircase and then go to the center of the building. So it was probably at least a couple minute walk or jog process to get that done if you forgot your headgear. And we'd be like getting ready to start practice, and I'd be like, Coach Douglas, I'm seeing some guys without headgears. That's an NCAA rule, right? And then he'd go, gosh, damn it, stop, practice, stop, headgears now. It'd be a scene every time. I'd probably do it at least once every couple weeks. And it was cool. And the guys that had to go get their headgears would be pissed. You're like, they're like, don't do it. Don't do it.
And you did that just to be ornery?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. And because I wanted to be compliant.
That's funny. What's the main thing you learned wrestling wise from Bobby Douglas? If you can point to one thing.
Bobby Douglas had watched more international film than anybody that I'd been a part of. So he could share so many skills from so many positions. And Bobby made you have the mindset that there's more than one way to skin a cat. You shouldn't like look at a position and say, if you get here, you have to do this to win. When let's say it's a high crotch, you might be able to like shelf it. You might be able to head hunt. You might be able to hip heist, whatever it is from your position. There's a lot of ways to win, and don't try to make people wrestle from a box. Give them four or five options in a position and then let them choose what fits best with their style of wrestling, their strength level, their body type. And for us, like, I think if you'll look at some teams and they'll all do the same thing from the same position. But in our era at Iowa State, I think you'd see 10 guys in the same position do 10 different things. It's because he gave you a menu.
Okay. So moving on to your international career, when you moved down to 145 and a half, which is just insane to me that you were able to do that. Because you made a world team in 2009 and your brother made one in 2010. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you both wanted to wrestle 163, but you decided to go down to 145 and a half. How did you guys decide who was going to go where?
At the time, Travis, he built into 65, but he walked around about 75. And the guys at 84 kilo, 184, were cutting from around 200. And he was nowhere near that. Even if strength-wise, he could kind of match it. We felt like if I was really, really disciplined with my diet, maybe I could do it. So that's why we went that route first. And I did it for 2 years. But by the end of the 2 years, I just couldn't do it. My body couldn't take it anymore. When I started getting dehydrated, my body would break out in hives from sitting in the sauna too long or extreme hot and colds. I couldn't get any leaner, and I had lost the muscle that I could lose, and it was just at a point where it wasn't healthy anymore. And yeah. So at that point, I didn't even care if Travis went up. I was like, I'm going 74 kilo. Like, we can either figure it out or – so that's why in 2010 we were the same weight. Yeah. And then afterwards our parents were like, never do that to us again.
Yeah.
And that's why he moved up the Olympic year.
Okay. So making that weight, I mean, you know, you wrestled 157 in college. I can't imagine you walked around at 160. So what did you walk around at in college? Like 170?
Yeah, low 70s. I walked around about 175 pretty lean.
Okay. So
it was tough.
During the season?
During the season, I walked around probably exactly at 170.
Okay. So you would still have to cut 13 just to make weight every week.
Yeah, but at that point, it'd be like a really hydrated 168, 170. So after a hard practice, you can lose 8 or 9 pounds. You're within 3.
Yeah. So you weren't killing yourself to make 57?
No.
Okay. You probably had it down to a science by that point.
The thing that was crazy was right when we got done competing freestyle was when they added 70 kilo and 79. That really? Was one of the things, like during our whole cycle, it was 45, 63, 84. That was like the world weight classes too. There wasn't the 10 for the world championships, 6 for the Olympics. It was just 6 period.
So, I mean, in a nutshell, like how did you make that weight? What kind of crazy things did you have to do?
I didn't really lift any weights. I did a lot of sauna circuits with resistance bands. I did a lot of cross training to get as lean as I possibly could. And then at my leanest, I was probably like 63, 65. And then everything else was just water weight within probably the 2 weeks.
So when you wrestled, how much would you bounce back up to after you made weight?
I remember the world team trials one year, I think. Either Olympic trials or world team trials. I can't remember, but I in the semifinals after I won, I got on the scale and I was 165.
Wow. So 20 pounds of water weight.
But back then you could weigh in the day before. So you weighed in at like 3 or 4 o'clock and then you didn't wrestle until the next day. So I almost over 24 hours. Yeah.
Okay. So was it hard to like ease, like, I don't know how to say this, like to when you eat and started drinking water again and stuff, was it hard on your body? Did you have to like make yourself go slow?
Yeah, if I just like started gorging, I'd get sick. It was a slow process. And the hardest match of every tournament was first round. If I could get through first round, then I was rolling. But it's just that first round, no matter how hard you warm up, no matter what you put in, you can't really simulate that first round feeling and how heavy your legs get and how tough it gets late in the match. But
so right before you made 145 and a half, were you just like, was your heart pounding out of your chest? Did you feel like you were going to die?
Yeah, I remember I made it in Krasnoyarsk once in Russia, and it's one of the coldest places. I think it was negative 20 there. I remember after I made weight, I went outside in shorts only and just sat there for like 20 minutes. Just trying to cool my body off.
Yeah. And who was your coach around that time at international?
So the college coaches, it was Kale was still around and Bono was still around and Cody and all those guys. But also our high school coach, Keith Massey, he'd come and train us. It was 2 hours from Council Bluffs. So he would actually fly out to like New York AC, Sunkiss, Bill Farrell, all those tournaments.
And Terry Brands was around for that too?
Yeah, Terry Brands was the resident coach of the training center. Okay. So when we go out there, he would be with us. He was coaching Bryce Hassman, who we were close with. So.
Okay. And to make your world team, you beat Brett Metcalf. Is that correct?
I beat Brett Metcalf in the finals of the U.S. Open. But for the world team, I beat Freyer, the best two out of three.
Okay. And then the next so he was the Olympian in 2008.
Yeah.
And then you beat him in.
Oh, he was the Olympian in 2012. Schwab was the Olympian in 2008. I beat Schwab in the semis of the U.S. Open in 2009. And then going into 2010, I was the number one guy at 65, but I couldn't make it anymore, so I moved up. And then Frey ended up making the team in 12.
It's crazy to me that you even wrestled Schwab, because he was pretty small in college, wasn't he? Like a 41-pounder?
Yeah, there was like a big size difference.
Yeah. So what were those matches like with did you only wrestle Metcalf once, or did you wrestle him multiple times?
No, he beat me. Where did he beat me? At the U.S. Open the year before. Maybe he beat me at the Olympic Trials. I'm trying to remember. But yeah, he beat me first, and then I beat him last.
What was he like to wrestle?
Extreme hand fighter. Very hard to beat his head hands. He had good head hands defense. And he would kneel in a lot, but he would kneel in just enough to, it'd be hard to re-attack him. But to try to get you to do like 99% of his points, what I studied on our film, it was kind of funny enough, similar to what Kendall Cross said when he wrestled Brands. He goes, when I watched all my matches with Brands, I realized that he scored 99% of his points when I shot on him. He's like, what I fixed at the Olympic trials, I stopped shooting. So with Metcalf, I tried to neutralize his hand fight and actually try to make him score on a leg attack, a committed leg attack. And then that's how I was able to turn the tides on him.
Explain to people who don't know how do you define hand fighting?
Because
I wrestled my whole life and I'm still like, I know what it is, but I don't know what it is. Like I don't know how to describe it to someone.
Some people in Iowa call it elegant violence, legal fighting. It's just pretty much you're pounding on the back of the dude's head or neck or grabbing their arm or getting whatever you can a hold of with a tight grip and pushing and pulling and constantly making the guy move his feet when he doesn't want to or work hard when he's just trying to stay in a strong stance. And over time, that gets them so fatigued that your moves either start working or they just concede stuff.
Okay. So how did that feel to finally make your world team?
About like it did for my NCAA title, a relief slash huge excitement slash like pride, a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Where were the worlds at that year?
Herning, Denmark.
Okay.
Kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and you had to wrestle during the ball draw era. Did that suck?
Yeah, it was terrible. Like my twin brother, when I made the team in 2009, he was in the world team trials against Dustin Schlater. And Dustin, he was a national champ stud, but what Dustin was known for was he had unbelievable defense. And all four periods went to the ball grab. and all four ball grabs were Slater singlet colored, no matter, like, because you switch singlet colors each match. So Travis went 0-for-4, and Slater just finished all four leg grabs, and he was on the world team. And I was like, Travis, you better never go to the casino. It's bad freaking luck. And I get it, like, you can't let it go to the ball grab. You got to score some points. But during that area in a 2-minute period when someone's in complete shutdown against the best guys, sometimes it is hard to score.
Yeah, I mean, how did they ever come up with that and think this is the way to go? Like, let the guy in on your leg and blow the whistle. And
I think it was Phil at the time. It was, I don't think it had transitioned to UWW yet, but I think it was the Europeans' way of slowing the match down and giving them better chances to win. Because when it was a longer match, when cardio was involved and you had to score 3 points, it didn't favor them. And we were starting to get more medals. I think it was their way to make kind of even the scales.
Did you have a favorite way to do freestyle? Like, did you like the 5-minute period, or obviously you probably didn't like the ball draw era, but is that all you tackled in?
My favorite was like at the very end of my career where they carried over the points. I didn't like it when you could tech a guy 6-0 and then lose on two ball grabs and you won the match 6-2, but you still lost because you lost 2 out of 3 periods.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have to be pretty frustrating. So how did your worlds go?
So first round I lost. So I had the guy from Kazakhstan and I was winning in the third period with like 10 seconds left on a restart. And he shot a swim high crotch and I was on my butt trying to scoot around him and we slid out of bounds, grounded, and they gave him a push out. And then that guy I think it's still that way today. If your guy doesn't make the finals, you don't get to come back. And he made the semifinals and lost third period clinch to the Russian who ended up winning it. And then he got third.
Yeah. So when you had to wrestle your brother, did you prepare the same way? Is it the same? You just like try to focus on the just being another match. You don't think about it being your brother.
I prepared the same way, but mentally when the match starts, it's a different ball game because you know how it is when you wrestle your teammate all the time. You're very familiar with your moves don't work as good because they know like when you're putting your hands here, you start moving your feet here, what's coming. It's like that to a whole nother level when you've been wrestling the dude since you could walk.
Yeah.
So it's much more of a chess match, much more strategic. And I mean, that's just the things that were going through my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the best I ever wrestled my whole life was a couple of weeks after the state tournament, my senior year, my brother and I wrestled in the front yard and we had this street where it was a pretty busy street. So the yard was big enough for us to wrestle without getting hit by a car, but there was a ton of traffic coming by. And I think we both got one takedown apiece, but we were scrapping, man. I mean, just tons of scrambles and I can only imagine what people thought driving by, but it's probably the best I've ever wrestled. And nobody could bring that out in me like him. So I can only imagine, especially with something like that on the line.
And then it's in your hometown and in front of like probably at least 100 friends and family that all have like Paulson Power t-shirts on. And like when you're wrestling, you can hear a pin drop. Not a single person's cheering. Both the coaches in the corners aren't coaching. It's just silent in the whole building.
Really? Why weren't the coaches coaching?
I think because Slay was both of our coaches at the training center. Then Coach Jackson was both of our coaches at Iowa State. So I think neither one of them really, they were just kind of sitting there. And then if there was like a challenging call, they'd throw a cue, but there was no strategy being shouted throughout the match.
Yeah. So now you're at University of Virginia and building a great program there. Tell me some about Steve Garland. I would love to have him on my podcast. I heard you saying something about his story and it made me like really want to know Steve Garland.
Yeah, he's a musket. He's the reason I came to Virginia is because of him sharing his testimony at the prayer breakfast at the NCAA tournament in 2017. We knew of Steve Garland, but we didn't know anything about him. The only reason we knew of him is because we trained on the national team with Keith Gavin, and he was Garland's assistant coach at the time. So he had said some good things, but we didn't really know him as a person. And at that prayer breakfast, the things he shared, maybe you tell like a best friend or someone that you're really close with, but he was telling it openly to a room full of like 300 people.
Can you expound on what he's talked about, or is that something I should just ask him?
I think he tells the story better than me, but he pretty much, he grew up in a broken home. His dad was an abusive alcoholic. His mom kind of left him, and in a rough town, Middletown, New York. And he had a twin brother, and him and his twin brother were at, I think it's Northern Connecticut. I can't remember the exact school. It was a D2 or D3 school. And they dropped the program after their freshman year. And when they dropped the program, the Virginia coach was calling that coach saying, like, do you have any good kids in your team that would transfer to Virginia? We're trying to build this program. And they weren't even calling about Steve Garland. They were just calling in general about other guys on the team. And Steve just happened to be in the office at the right time. He's like, tell them about me. I'll be full need-based aid. Just like, give me a chance. And then he actually talked the Virginia coach into getting him to come out for a visit. Came, fell in love with it, and then he was an NCAA finalist his senior year. And if you look at where he was at, he didn't even win his wrestle off at Northern Connecticut or whatever it was. And then his junior year of college, he lost the wrestle off. The guy ended up being an All-American, so he was pretty good. But losing your wrestle off your junior year to being NCAA finalist your senior year is a pretty big jump.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to talk to him if you would facilitate that meeting. It'd be cool. I would love to get him on here and hear that story. I think I would really appreciate hearing it.
He's pretty polished too. He's an excellent public speaker. We always say when he speaks that he's using his gift, like, and we'll act like we're putting on lipstick, like, Steve, use your gift, and like we'll go like that, like, dude, like, knock that shit off. But he. When he speaks, it's like the way I describe it is like he's a military leader and he's someone you would want to get behind to go to war with. He stands for the right things. He is who he is when no one's looking, and he's a man of his word. And that can be hard to find these days.
Do you want to stay at Virginia forever, or would you like to be a head coach somewhere? Or
I really don't have aspirations to be a head coach. What I want to do is I see Garland's schedule. He's got about 1 to 2 weekends the whole year where he doesn't have some type of obligation. I want to be there for my kids. That's my number one. And I love assistant wrestling coaching because I can still get in there and grind. And I think sometimes when you're the figurehead, you're the head coach, you got to be the bad guy a lot. And sometimes you can like develop a little bit better, like personal relationships when you're an assistant. Cause you're like in the pits and valleys, not to say Garland doesn't do that. Cause he does that as well, but that's the way I've looked at it at this point. But my twin brother, I think, wants to be a head coach someday. So if he gets an opportunity, maybe I would go with him, but for the time being, Virginia's awesome.
Do you and Travis ever wrestle anymore?
Not each other, but yeah, I still get on the mat 4 days a week. I never miss a practice pretty much since I've been here. Preseason this year, I tore my ACL. It's like the first major injury I've had. So I'm just at the 6-month mark now. So I'm starting to light drill again. It feels good to be back.
Yeah, I bet. So do you guys rotate in and out on people and they don't know who the hell they're even wrestling half the time?
No, they can tell because I shaved my head and Travis is still holding on.
Okay.
If we don't have hats on, you're pretty easy to tell.
Yeah. Well, I won't keep you on here all day, but I did have like a little bit of a lightning round of questions for you. So for your international career, you did spend some time with Terry Brands, who has always kind of intrigued me. I mean, both the Brands, you know, when I was in high school, I was kind of scared to wrestle in college because I thought everybody was like that. And I've always kind of thought of Terry Brands as like, he's like the Tasmanian devil of wrestling. You know, if you could put the Tasmanian devil in a singlet, I feel like that's what it would be like to wrestle Terry Brands. So what's that dude like?
So my experience with the Brands was I was at Iowa State. They were obviously running Iowa. So like you hated the Brands. They're like the opposing force, like the in-state rival. And they're pretty animated and they like to get in your head from just being in the corner. So it kind of started as a hatred towards them. And then when I actually worked with Terry at the training center when he was the resident coach, they're actually pretty hilarious. they have really good senses of humor. You wouldn't guess that. And two, when you like peel behind the layer of their craziness, they're crazy like that because they love their guys so much and they want to do anything they can to help them win. And sometimes it doesn't always come across as like the best way, but you can't say they're not passionate for their dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. It bothers me, frankly, when people, like, I've been in the stands at NCAAs and people talking crap on the brands. I'm like, you wouldn't say that to that guy's face.
Yeah. I don't know Tom as well, but Terry's always been good to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I would like to get them on here too. And I would love to talk to them, even though I'd probably be a little bit nervous. I'd be like, I'd go back to when I was 18 or something. So you spent time with some of the very best the sport has to offer and been around them in their primes. You know, you were at Nebraska when Jordan Burroughs was there. Did you wrestle Kyle Dake in like,
I wrestled him at the Olympic trials in 2012.
Okay. I couldn't remember when that was. I do remember watching the match. So you've wrestled Kyle Dake, you've wrestled Burroughs, you've been around Cale Sanderson. Gun to your head, who's the best of those guys?
I'd say the toughest guy for me that I've actually had to compete against was Burroughs because of his diverse offense. He's one of the few quick twitch guys that I've wrestled that doesn't fade. That dude has crazy heart, and there's a lot of fast dudes with great offense, but the way he's able to mix it up, he shoots like the half knee pull to the chain wrestle double, or how he can lull you to sleep and just explode. He wrestled some of the best, toughest hand fighters and never stopped coming. And that's kind of what stood out to me. And Dake is special in his own right, but Dake, when I wrestled him, what stood out to me was his head hands defense. It was almost impossible to beat his head. And even if you do get to his legs, his balance, his strength in those positions is something that was very rare. And Cale, it's hard for me to, like, obviously watching him, he's right up there with anybody, but he's just so much bigger that it's hard for me to judge from like a competition standpoint of something I felt. But what Cale did was, I'm sure you've watched Cale quite a bit. When he wrestled, it looked like he was not trying. Like, it was like he was in a spar state and just constantly like a step ahead of his competition. It's not like Cale had crazy good speed or crazy good strength. What Cale had was crazy good feel.
Okay.
And able to chain action.
It's kind of like how Ed Ruth was. Like, he would get to legs and you're like, I know it's not as easy to get to legs as he makes it look. But he was crazy with that. And Burroughs, I've seen him wrestle, like, when he wrestled Isaiah Martinez, they had some pretty good matches. But he's so quick twitch, like you mentioned, that, like, people would just be worn out by the end of it. I think they would get worn out just by, like, what's he going to do? What's he going
to
do?
Yeah, you have to respect every fake because he will blast through you. And when he hits you, it's like 99% of people, when they shot on me, if they hit me full force, I was strong enough to level change and pull him up with an underhook or slide off. When Jordan Burroughs hit you and got his pinkies behind your knees, there was no getting your legs back. Huh. He's just a freight train.
What was your greatest attribute as a wrestler and still a greatest attribute as a wrestler?
I'd say positionally, it was hard to beat my head hands too. If I could get to your body, 9 times out of 10, I could put you on your back. And if I got my hand around your leg, I was almost always finishing.
Okay.
I didn't shoot a ton, but if I shot, there was a very high likelihood that I was going to score.
Okay.
I'd say more methodical.
Can you point to who the best guy you've ever wrestled is? Would you say that was Burroughs?
Burroughs is up there. That Russian that Burroughs went back and forth with, the Russian that beat Burroughs in the 2016 Olympics. I can't remember. It starts with a G, his last name, but he was really good. I wrestled him in a duel in Ossetia.
That guy almost, I don't want to say he was juicing, but I don't know how you get like that dude was. I know who exactly you're talking about, and I can't think of his name either.
Yeah, that guy. And when I wrestled that guy, it was the very first competition of me moving up from 145 to 163. It was like my first trip overseas. And I remember after I wrestled him, the coaches were like, you need to go back to 45. And I was like, no. I was like, I know that guy was good, but I think I could beat him. But it's just that, yeah, that dude was strong and athletic, and he was tough.
Yeah. Gosh, it's bugging me now that I can't think of his name, but yeah, what a freaking beast. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But so will you be at the U.S. Open? Are you going to go watch this year?
You mean Olympic trials or?
Well, they're still having the U.S. Open in April, right, or no?
Oh, yeah, that's – so, yeah, U20s, we're sending four of our college guys. The senior guys wrestled in Texas in December, so I think it's just U20 on down. But okay. we'll have four of our guys wrestling there, and then we'll be out there recruiting as well.
Okay. I was just curious because I might go watch. Maybe I'll meet you in person. But
yeah, that'd be cool.
Who was the biggest influence on your life, would you say?
There's a lot of people. I hate to put that in one person, but a big person would be my dad. He just a first generation American that through hard work, and he kind of built a legacy for us and set my mom up to be taken care of after he was gone. And just the things he constantly preached to us, work hard, be humble. And like when we'd have like tough wrestling competitions, he'd always say stuff like, I know that like there's a lot of studs in this weight class, or maybe not on paper, you're not supposed to win, but everybody has to sit down and take a, like, use the restroom. Like, everyone has to sit on the same toilet. There's no one that's like superhuman, and just always supported us no matter what.
Yeah. I read that quote, work hard and be humble. And I think that's something that I'm going to start saying to my boy, just about life in general, you know, like, one of my goals in life is to be a good dad, and it's not always easy. I feel like I'm making mistakes all the time. But I want to be a good dad. And my dad did a lot of things that, you know, I don't think he realized at the time what he was doing that were, you know, not necessarily positive. But I like to ask people who I think are probably good dads, like, I bet you're a great dad. What's your best advice for getting your kid to fall in love with that, in love with wrestling without, you know, I don't want to be that psycho dad. I just want to be supportive of him. And it's one of the few things I know something about that I would like to pass on to him.
I'd say for me, it's with the results, unconditional love. Their value is never based on a result, and just they're proud of their effort, and they're going to run. There's like kids their age, like even at like the 8-year-old, there's kids like that. I don't know if they started training out of the womb. They already look like technically college wrestlers for that age group. And a lot of times kids like that, by the time they get to high school, they're not even wrestling anymore. So having like the vision of like, you don't have to kill yourself or kill your kid's spirit trying to get them to get down a certain move at that age. Just love the process, love working hard, love the balance of like, obviously not every practice is live and not every practice is a 2-hour technique. It's sometimes you play a 20, 30 minute game. Sometimes you do sharks and minnows. Sometimes you just let them sit back and have fun and figure stuff out on their own.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I appreciate that. It's definitely something I hope that he enjoys and likes and wants to do. But you're right. I've seen a lot of kids. I remember a lot of kids that were great when we were kids that didn't even make it to high school because their parents were so, you know,
the crazy helicopter dads.
What's a helicopter dad?
Like, you're always over top of them. You're like always watching, can't make them, let them make decisions on their own. Even if they win, it's not good enough. They're doing treadmill sprints or like, it's pretty common in the sport. And yet you'll see guys that are even big recruits that have successful high school careers. And by the time they get to the college level, they're just either so burnt out or so like, have animosity towards the sport of almost the abuse they went through to get to the level they're at that point, that yeah. It's not conducive. It's just, I've seen it a ton.
I bet. And cutting weight too, I think, is a big mistake that a lot of, I mean, I have a borderline eating disorder to this day from cutting too much weight, I think. And especially in the 90s, good Lord, we didn't do it the right way. We would just kill ourselves and then eat like a dump truck and
yeah,
and all that.
I was part of that era too. Like from cutting to 45, I still can't eat like sweet potatoes now today because that was like one of the main things that I had a lot with my meals.
Yeah.
It's like if I have a sweet potato, I just like go back to cutting to 45 and it's just not good.
What do you walk around at right now?
Like pretty much what I always did, right around 175.
Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this, buddy. Is there anything you would like to say before I let you go?
The only thing I'd say on like the dad thing, the, like, have you coached at all with wrestling or anything like that?
No, never. But
I was just going to give the analogy, like a lot of our young guy, like Jake Keating or like other guys that have recently graduated from college. Now they're helping our team in coaching roles. They're like, it's so frustrating when you like speak from the heart and like, you know what this kid needs to do. And it doesn't matter what you say or how much you want something to happen. It has to be their decision. So finding ways to guide them like that and approach it in different ways. Like okay. The parables I talked about, like the work hard and be humble, however they translate that. Approach it, don't just keep pounding the same way and thinking it's eventually going to get through. Try to be innovative like that. And just like coaching is, being a dad is like the most challenging yet the most rewarding job that you'll ever have. And yeah. Just cherishing it, because I remember, I can't believe they've already been wrestling 3 years now, because it seems like yesterday we were starting in peewees and they could barely do a penetration step. Now they're both chain wrestling pretty good and into, and it just cherish it. Because I remember my dad passed away from cancer 9 years ago, almost 10. And about a month before he went, it was like the last time that he could talk. And he said, I can't put into words how much I love you. And I can't explain to you how fast life goes. And don't get busy with stuff that doesn't matter. Cherish each day and live in the moment. Because especially in America, there's so many distractions. Everybody wants to be on their phone. Everybody wants to do the next thing, the side hustle, whatever it is. Don't get distracted by all that, because it goes fast and the memories that you have are what you make of them. You don't want to go through life and you have a bunch of money in the bank account, but you didn't invest in your kid. You don't want to take the promotion where you're not at home. It's evaluate what's truly important, and then you have a pretty good lens. What's your why?
Okay. Yeah, I really appreciate that, man. Damn near, I'm a pretty sentimental person. It almost made me tear up hearing you say that about your dad. And I can imagine how proud he was of you guys. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, buddy.
Yeah, thanks.
You bet, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. And this will probably be up tomorrow. So if you wouldn't mind sharing it or whatever, that'd be great.
Yeah, I will. And I'll get on Garland to get on. And hopefully we can run into each other in Vegas.
Yeah, that'd be great, man. That's just in a... When is that going to be then?
So we leave not this Thursday, but next. We fly out there.
Okay.
And then compete awesome. Friday and Saturday.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, I'll let you know if I can make it out there. And God bless you. Thanks so much for taking the time. And we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Trent. Bye-bye. All right, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to this edition of Wrestling Wednesday. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Trent Paulson is the man. I'm looking forward to seeing how well Virginia does in the future. Him and his brother and Steve Garland, they got a great thing going on there. And so cool to be able to do these. I really appreciate you guys tuning in. Make sure you go to Making It Happen, MACANItHappen.com. Help out little Bo Macon and his family. And make sure you get tickets to see me and my buddy Kurt Fletcher at the Funny Bone in Des Moines, April 26 and 27. I believe there's only two shows, one Friday, one Saturday. Great club. Looking forward to it. And thanks for tuning in and supporting this podcast. God bless all of you and have a great day.